This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, house sparrows. Maybe a household name, but why is this species considered invasive in Wisconsin? We'll get to the bottom of one of the state's most commonly seen birds. Now, Wisconsin kicked off a new year in politics yesterday with the re-inauguration of Governor Evers and a swearing-in for the Republican-led legislature. And it's a big year with budget negotiations on the horizon and a pool of extra cash to work with. In his inaugural speech, Evers called for many of his campaign priorities, including expanding Medicaid and repealing the state's abortion ban.
People voted because they believe, as I do, that we should expand Badger Care and work to ensure everyone has access to quality, affordable health care, because it's 2023 and they believe we shouldn't be beholden to a law from the 1800s passed well before women had the right to vote.
In response, Republican State Assembly Leader Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahieu expressed disappointment with what they called partisan messaging in Evers' speech. Both sides of the political aisle in Wisconsin have at least expressed a willingness to work together more during this next budget cycle. That hasn't happened a lot in the last few years of divided government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see in state politics in 2023? What priorities would you like to see in the upcoming budget negotiations? Are you optimistic, hopeful that Democrats and Republicans could work together this time around? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Anthony Trigoski is an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. He teaches about government, politics, and media. Anthony, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, set the stage for us for 2023. What are you looking at as the biggest stories in state politics this year?
A few things, Rob. First of all, the showdown surrounding abortion, the 174-year-old abortion ban. It really restricts abortion in nearly all cases. That was a major theme of Governor Evers' speech yesterday. He talked about his desire for people to have the right to choose. He also interestingly connected the issue of abortion to the state's economic development strategy. He said that a very restrictive abortion law could potentially discourage businesses and residents from relocating into Wisconsin. We know that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, the top Republican in the state assembly, has expressed some frustration recently with the state's economic development strategy. So it was an interesting response by Governor Evers to turn things around on Speaker Voss and say, well, it's actually the abortion ban and other issues that he thinks are out of step with public opinion that could be hampering the state's economic development, that could be hampering the state's ability to draw in new businesses and new residents. In addition, Rob, you mentioned the fact that the Wisconsin state government is flush with cash, projected to be now a nearly $7 billion budget surplus. That is going to be the major theme of these budget negotiations. What to do with the budget surplus? The Republicans want to go big on tax cuts. Meanwhile, Tony Evers is calling for increased funding for local governments, and he's calling for increased funding for public education. And finally, Rob, what also looms large is that upcoming state Supreme Court election. It could potentially shift the balance of power on the state Supreme Court from a conservative majority, currently a 4-3 conservative majority, to potentially a 4-3 liberal majority. So it is a high stakes state Supreme Court election coming up on April 4th. A lot to watch as we see how things unfold between Governor Evers and the Republican-controlled state legislature on one side of the split screen. And then on the other side of the split screen, we've got yet another campaign, yet another high stakes campaign going on here in the state of Wisconsin.
So for those non-election issues, including abortion and the state budget, a lot is contingent on a Democratic governor, Republican lawmakers working together. Governor Evers has said, hey, maybe we can do that. Assembly Leader Robin Voss has said, maybe we can do that. Here's Evers in the inaugural speech talking about trying to put aside personal interests.
Wisconsinites reaffirm that our duty and allegiance, first and foremost, is not to our own interests, but to each other. Resolve to the common good that binds us, vehement about the values that unite us, and steadfast to the ideals that transcend us.
Okay, sounds peachy, Anthony, but we know that there have been long periods of time where Governor Evers and Republican leaders in the legislature didn't talk to each other, much less compromise or agree with each other. Do you have any sense that things might change this year?
The tone is one of optimism, Rob. A tone of optimism that perhaps these next 4 years could be a bit different than the last 4 years. The last 4 years were characterized by bitter partisan struggles between the Democratic Governor Evers and the Republican-controlled state legislature. So you do have Republican leaders in the legislature and Governor Evers portraying a bit of a different tone this time. And so that could be a sign that perhaps a bit more cooperation is on the horizon. On the other hand, we do know that hardball politics is the norm in Wisconsin. We look at the state legislature, and Republicans have rock-solid majorities in the state legislature, overwhelming majorities in both the state assembly and the state senate. So Republicans have very secure majorities and are really at no risk of losing their majorities as long as the Democrats are really uncompetitive in rural areas and as long as these current legislative maps remain in place that strongly favor the Republican Party. So Republicans can certainly play hardball in the sense that they really have no risk of losing their majorities. On the other hand, Rob, Tony Evers won re-election in 2022 by a larger margin than he won election in 2018. So you could have an emboldened Governor Evers. So there is the potential for both sides to be emboldened to play hardball. On the other hand, we have seen a bit of a different tone from Governor Evers and the key leaders in the state legislature, state Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and State Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu.
Talking to Anthony Chergosky from UW La Crosse, looking at the year in state politics, the re-inauguration of Governor Evers yesterday, Republican-led state legislature re-sworn in. You could join in at 800-642-1234. It's a big budget year. What do you want to see the state spending money on? What priorities do you want to see? Are there changes to taxes that you'd like to see? Education funding, local government funding? You fill in the blank, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Anthony, we've got a budget. It's a big deal. We've got a big budget surplus going into this one. Does that offer some room for some horse trading where everybody gets a little bit of what they want?
Absolutely, Rob. We know that the Republicans want a major tax cut. They have talked about going to a flat tax for the state income tax, where everyone would pay the same tax rate, regardless of their income. We do know that that is a non-starter with Governor Evers, but perhaps it is the opening bid, so to speak, by Republicans, and they're willing to move. We do know that last time around, the Republicans enacted a $3 billion plus dollar tax cut. That was in the last budget cycle, and they want something similar this time around. On the other hand, we know that Governor Evers wants at least $2 billion in additional funding for public schools. He wants more money for local governments. The good news, Rob, is that there might be enough money to go around. The state is in an extraordinarily strong fiscal position, the strongest that we've had in recent memory, a $7 billion surplus just around that dollar amount. So we might have the chance for each side to have their cake and eat it too. It's certainly going to be difficult because both sides see opportunity in this budget surplus, a real once in a generation type situation, but it's a heck of a lot easier to negotiate in a positive budgetary climate than a negative, a problematic, a difficult budgetary climate. So I think there's room for negotiation here.
So we're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Mac is with us in Milwaukee. Mac, what are you looking for?
I would love to see, and it's not going to happen with the unrepresentative Republican houses of Congress, but I would love to see if the state changed the way that transportation funding works. I know calling from Milwaukee, a lot of the roads here are owned by the state. And so local communities don't have power over what those roads look like. And then Milwaukee ends up giving a lot of our money to the state, and then we don't get it back, and they write rules about us not being able to spend it on buses or trains, and we aren't even allowed to start like a municipal transportation authority in order to fund things like buses or trains. So it's really frustrating.
Mac, thanks a lot for the call. Anthony Mac pointing toward a long-running and fiendishly complicated part of our state budget, how we fund roads, who is in charge of which roads, things like that. Any thought that people might try to tackle that?
You know, Rob, one possibility is to use the budget surplus on one-time expenses. And so roads, expanded funding for transportation could be part of that. A big question with the budget surplus is how much do you bake in some permanent spending changes or tax changes into the budget? And how much do you use on one-time expenses, like increased funding for one-time transportation projects? Mac's comment also makes me think of local government funding. Mm-hmm. Both sides agree that the system of funding local governments is broken, and that shared revenue from the states flowing into the local governments, that is simply not a workable system at this point, that the system needs reform. We've got quite a contrast, Rob, where the state is flush with cash. Meanwhile, local governments are continuously going to the voters on referendum to seek funding for just fulfilling the basic services of local government. So you've got a state that is flush with cash. Meanwhile, you've got local governments in Wisconsin that are struggling to fulfill the basic services that they have to fulfill. So it is quite a contrast when you look at the budget position of the state versus local governments. I do think that's one other situation where there's room for a deal. Both sides agree that there is a problem. They obviously disagree on the potential solutions. But hey, the first step is for both sides across the aisle to agree that there is a real problem here. And I do think both sides recognize that we've got a real problem in Wisconsin when it comes to funding for local governments.
Thanks for that call, Mac. We're talking to UW La Crosse political science professor Anthony Trigoski about the year ahead in Wisconsin politics, including upcoming budget negotiations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see Wisconsin do with its budget surplus this time around? Do you think Governor Evers or Republican lawmakers will be able to enact their priorities? What do you want to see happen on big issues, including the budget, abortion? Are you watching this state Supreme Court election coming up? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Anthony Trigoski, political science professor at UW La Crosse, with us today looking at what's in store for Wisconsin politics this year with divided government and the two-year budget on the table. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the agenda for Wisconsin state government this year? What issues do you want to see addressed? What priorities do you want to see in the budget? Do you work in local or county government? What do you want to see the state do for you? Do you want to get a taste of that surplus? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We heard from Joel on Facebook saying neither protecting abortion rights or expanding Medicare, as Governor Evers called for, are going to happen. Why not focus on things which have bipartisan support? Let's get to that abortion debate here. The status quo right now, that 1849 law with a couple of revisions soon after in effect in Wisconsin, one of the more restrictive abortion laws in the state, that if Governor Evers wants change and Republicans in the legislature don't, then we stay there, right?
Absolutely, Rob. There is a standoff right now over this issue. Now, there are different strategies on both sides. On the side of the Republicans in the legislature, they are thinking about adding exceptions for rape and incest into the current law, the law that was passed in 1849. That is really one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the nation. So Republicans realized that they did have a problem in the midterm elections when it came to this highly restrictive abortion law. When you look at the Marquette polling numbers, Rob, it is clear that the 1849 law on abortion is just radically out of step with public opinion in Wisconsin. And so I think Republicans understand that. They understand that this is a political liability for them, and they maybe want to move things more in the direction of public opinion. At the same time, Governor Evers just wants to go back to the situation that was the case under Roe versus Wade. And so there is a big gap between the two sides, even though they both want to make a change to the law. Governor Evers' strategy is to fight this out through the courts. He thinks that that is the best way to achieve a return to the situation under Roe versus Wade. Meanwhile, Republicans, most notably Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, seem to be concerned about the prospect of the upcoming state Supreme Court election being dominated by the issue of abortion. That is a very real possibility. And we know that the current 1849 law, as I mentioned, is deeply unpopular in Wisconsin. So both sides want to make some revisions to the law. Governor Evers wants to make substantial revisions, essentially going back to the situation that we had prior to the overturning of Roe versus Wade. Meanwhile, Republicans want to add some additional situations in which abortion would be permitted. But ultimately, I don't see a prospect for a compromise here because the two sides are simply too far apart.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Perry in Oconto. Perry, hi.
Hi. Happy New Year. My question for the guest from La Crosse is there any way that voters can demand fairer election maps? Are we stuck with these maps for the next 10 years? It doesn't seem like the Republicans want to bring any compromise to the floor for a vote. It's almost like the Packers get 7 points for every score and the opposing team, no matter what they do, only gets 3 points.
Perry, thanks a lot for the call. There's no direct method for voting. We don't have that sort of referendum process that other states do, Anthony. I think some eyes are on the state Supreme Court election saying, hey, if a challenge to our current maps finds its way to the state Supreme Court after the majority switches to liberal-backed justices, I don't know. Is that something that could change then?
Oh, that is absolutely correct. And that is why Democrats have so much focus on this upcoming state Supreme Court election. Rob, as we mentioned, as long as these maps remain in place, it is almost unthinkable that the Republicans could lose their majority control. Now, Republicans will argue that it's really a matter of the Democratic Party's collapse of support in rural areas, that that's the reason the Republicans enjoy such overwhelming majorities. There is a bit of truth to that. The Democrats have seen their support collapse in rural areas, and that really hampers their ability to be competitive in the battle for seats in the state legislature. But at the same time, there is just absolutely no question that these district maps radically favor the Republican Party and that there is simply no imaginable way for the Republicans to lose their majorities unless something drastic changes. Now, the drastic thing that could change is a state Supreme Court ruling that forces a redraw of the maps. And that, again, is why Democrats are so focused on this upcoming state Supreme Court election that could flip the majority from a 4-3 conservative majority to a 4-3 liberal majority. That really opens the way for not just a ruling on the 1849 abortion law, but a ruling on the gerrymandered district map. So much attention is going to the state Supreme Court election. So much rides on this. And that is why we've got just a very busy upcoming few months in Wisconsin politics. The budget process will play itself out. And then we've got this extremely high stakes state Supreme Court election going on right along with it.
Thanks for the call, Perry. We're talking to Anthony Trigosky from UW La Crosse, looking at the year ahead in Wisconsin politics. Back to your calls now. We've got Nate on the line in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I was thinking that we might actually get some of Governor Evers' appointments finally dealt with. I hope with the budget, we might actually get some of the federal money coming our way that we could have a while ago. I know back in the day under Walker, Republicans were actually willing to spend millions in state money to turn down federal money, like with the trains. Now we might have to spend a little bit, but we'll also get a bunch with the Medicaid money, if I believe that works out. Also, since the legislative elections are kind of rigged, I feel obligated to vote in the elections where I can vote and matter, and that does mean the state Supreme Court race you just mentioned. Ironically enough, if Hagedorn hadn't ruled the way he did last time, I wouldn't feel so motivated to for this year because it would be less of an issue, and now it's more of one.
Nate, thanks for the call, referring to Brian Hagedorn, state Supreme Court justice, ultimately voting for the current district maps, I believe. Anthony, he mentioned, actually, Nate mentioned right off the top something we haven't gotten into yet. All the Governor Evers appointees who are as yet unconfirmed by the state Senate, we're seeing some of the holdovers, Walker appointees, saying, okay, we're done now.
Absolutely, Rob. That was one of the major storylines of Governor Evers' first term, and it was really indicative of the continuation of hardball politics in the state of Wisconsin. The state Senate simply did not hold hearings on a number of Governor Evers' key appointees. Now, we have seen a number of them step down in the aftermath of Governor Evers getting reelected. So we'll have to see what the posture of the state Senate is towards Governor Evers' appointees, and if they are a bit more willing to hold hearings and to hold confirmation votes on Governor Evers' appointees. But that really did stand out to me, Rob, as just a sign of how previously routine things in Wisconsin politics were no longer routine. It used to be just a matter of routine that the governor's appointees would get hearings and would get confirmation votes. What we've seen in Wisconsin politics is that previously routine things are no longer routine. Previously routine things can no longer be counted on to actually happen. And certainly the hearings and votes for the confirmation of the governor's appointees is one of those things. So it's something I'm watching very closely in the state Senate to see if they move a little bit on the appointees of the governor.
Anthony, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Anthony Chergosky, assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Anthony teaches about government, politics, and media there. He's with us today for a preview of the upcoming year in Wisconsin politics and state budget negotiations. Lots of news to come. Follow it at WPR.org and on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and you can weigh in there on the things you would like to see in this year's two-year state budget. Again, find that news on the Ideas Network Facebook page or at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, trout season kicks off this weekend for inland streams here in the state. Check out the state of trout and their habitats in Wisconsin and join in if you are going fishing this weekend. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll look at the impact of a Wisconsin law known as the Unborn Child Protection Act, intended to prevent drug use during pregnancy. It can give authorities the power to detain people without their consent. Now, finally, we're going to get some answers to questions that we know may or may not have been on anyone's minds recently about the humble house sparrow. The song of the sparrow there. Why? Well, a couple months back, I talked to the author of a book who said we should pay more attention to the birds around us, even, you know, the boring ones, the ones you don't go out and try to find. I tried. The birds I see the most lately are these house sparrows, in some ways arguably the boringest of birds. Nicholas Anich is a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I'm being a little unfair to the house sparrow here. They're actually, I think, kind of interesting when you start to look at them. But first, for non-bird watchers like me, can you give us a basic description of those house sparrows?
Yeah, so they are a little bit on the boring side. They are kind of a brown and gray bird, what people typically think of when they think of a sparrow.
Yeah, and when I looked up descriptions, they used words like, you know, dingy and dull in describing the colors. These are official descriptions. These don't really pop out at you, do they?
No, and in some way they have kind of earned their bad reputation, as they are a non-native species to this continent.
Yeah, and I was reading up on this. I remember hearing a story of a guy in the 19th century who introduced birds that he'd read about in Shakespeare and introduced them to the U.S. These were at least initially deliberately introduced in the U.S. and took off and spread all over?
Yeah, during the 1800s, it was a big thing. There were these acclimatization societies where European immigrants wanted their familiar plants and animals around them. And so for better or worse, they introduced, you know, dozens of species to other places.
In the winter, it seems like house sparrows, if you want to look up and see a bird, they're the most likely one you're going to find. Why have they so successfully adapted in Wisconsin and a lot of the rest of the country?
Well, they've basically adapted to be around humans. So whenever they were introduced to areas where people occupied They like feeding on, you know, seeds and spilled grains and other things like that. So they're very, you're not going to find them in the deep woods, but if you are in a sizable city or a farm area, they are very common there.
Now, when I look up house sparrows online, it seems like a lot of the common questions are negative. How do I get rid of house sparrows? Or are house sparrows crowding out native species in Wisconsin? Are they a problem for local native species?
Well, they can be a problem, and the real bad thing about them is that they're a cavity nester, and so they are going to be using birdhouses that other native species like eastern bluebird or purple martin might be using. So that's kind of the worst part about them, and they are kind of aggressive. So if you're trying to get bluebirds to nest in your box and you have house sparrows around, they might kick out the bluebirds and take the box.
Now, I've described them as boring. I hope they're not listening so they don't attack me at the bus stop tomorrow. But are there things you find interesting, maybe fascinating, about house sparrows and their behavior?
Well, I mean, they have successfully colonized basically the whole world except for Antarctica. They are very comfortable around humans. They're very persistent. I mean, they love nesting in little cracks in the wall and very hardy. So, I mean, they are, you know, kind of victorious as far as colonizing the world.
Do we have any sense? I don't know if we have numbers or if we can even keep track of numbers. But do we have a sense of their prevalence, how many of them are in the state?
Yeah, they are among the top 10 most common species, along with European starling, which is another exotic species. So they have kind of quickly jumped up the list to be quite common.
Talking to Nicholas Anich, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, looking at the house sparrows, a common bird you can see in the winter here in Wisconsin, especially in towns and cities. I also wanted to ask you, though, Nicholas, you are working on a new edition, second edition of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, that's right. It's a statewide citizen science project. And so the first bird atlas occurred from 1995 to 2000. And we just finished the field work for this one from 2015 to 2019. We had over 3,500 surveyors, and we gridded up the whole state into blocks that are about 3 miles by 3 miles. And we went into 1,200 of those blocks to collect data on all of the birds that were nesting there. And so with the most recent atlas, we've accrued 2.8 million observations, and we were collecting data in eBird, which is the popular online app for reporting your bird sightings. During that window, there were 8 million bird observations reported to eBird for Wisconsin. And so we have spent the last couple of years combing through all the atlas data and all the regular eBird data to try to make sure that everything lines up, looking at the time of year, the location, trying to vet that data before we move on to the more exciting steps of analyzing it to see how all of our bird species have changed in the last 20 years.
I know you're still vetting the data, and I don't know, maybe you don't want to spoil things or anything, but has anything stood out to you or surprised you so far as you're digging deep into this data?
Well, like any scientist, I'll put the asterisk that this is all preliminary, but, you know, initial analyses have kind of revealed some general trends, winners and losers, if you will, species whose range has grown or shrunk in the last 20 years. Some of the big losers are birds that are, we are at the southern edge of their range, so most of their range is in like the Canadian boreal forest. So these are birds like Canada jay or boreal chickadee or blackback woodpecker or Connecticut warbler. Those are some of the species that we are seeing reduced range, and they are retracting and leaving the state. Another big category of birds that aren't doing that great is grassland birds. Birds like northern bobwhite, upland sandpiper, western meadowlark. Those are birds that, you know, perhaps more intensive agricultural practices are harming. On the flip side, we do have some big gainers. You know, like the birds who we're at the southern end of their range, they are gradually shifting north. The birds where most of their range is to the south of us, we are getting more of them. So some of those species would be Carolina wren, tufted titmouse, and orchard oriole. Those are some of the big gainers. Another theme for gainers is raptors. You probably know that since banning DDT, raptor populations have been doing a lot better. So birds like peregrine falcon, bald eagle, and merlin were doing quite a bit better. And then amongst our biggest gainer is trumpeter swan.
Interesting. We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Nicholas Anich, conservation biologist with the state DNR. He joins us to talk about house sparrows and preview the DNR's Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas 2. Now it's Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a comeback story about a special band of horses.
Thousands of Ojibwe horses once roamed in the northern United States and Canada in the early 20th century. But the rare breed almost disappeared by the late 1970s. Then recently, a descendant of the White Earth Nation rescued six Ojibwe horses and gave them a home in northwestern Wisconsin. WPR's Danielle Kading brings us this story about Emily Lorzel and the Humble Horse Organization, which aims to keep the rare breed alive.
I know, Mama. White Earth Indigenous cause. Mityu or Ojibwe Anishinaabe Kwe Mityu. So that's a traditional Ojibwe protocol greeting. My name is Emily Lorzel. I founded this, and my husband and I, we both live on site, so we attend to all of the daily needs of the herd, including things like fundraising and outreach and stuff like that. But it's a volunteer-ran organization, so we don't get paid for anything that we do. All the donations go straight back for the horses. A part of our mission here at the Humble Horse is to preserve the breed and to hopefully one day repatriate them back to Anishinaabe communities.
Itchy. In Anishinaabe culture, if you don't have a name, your ancestors can't find you, so we gave everybody Anishinaabe names.
That's Nojimo, or we call her Jimmy, and that's Dimi, but we call her Mama, and then there's Baswewe, which is Echo, and then this is Nimki, who I guarantee you, once you start giving him pets, he will stalk you to the end of days, because he is like, hi, Mama, just the friendliest. I have an Auntie Siobhan Marks and a Uncle Mark Denning. Uncle Mark actually grew up with these horses, or he grew up with ponies, these small little ponies in the forest, right? I learned about these horses from him, and he would always tell me that his dream was to see these horses back in Wisconsin, because as he was growing up with them, they eventually kind of disappeared. What we do know is there were only about four left in 1976. The last stallion was shot by a non-Indigenous researcher who thought he was a moose in the 1960s. So with only four mares left in 1976, and the Canadian government saying, these guys are a public nuisance, we're going to destroy them, four members from Fort Boyce and Lac La Croix Nations got together in the middle of the night, loaded these four mares up onto a horse trailer, actually border hopped over the ice. It's called Heist Across the Ice. And they found sanctuary in a farm in Minnesota. They were able to repopulate, and they were crossbred with a Spanish Mustang that was kind of the most phenotypically similar to the breed. So all of the horses today are related to those four mares. I didn't know we had horses until I was in my early 20s. And why is it that I didn't know about these horses until I was that age? These horses were so vital to our survival. And what's cool about it is it was a consensual relationship. We didn't have to keep them penned up. They would come back every year around the winter to help us check trap lines, haul logs. There's even stories of them pawing through ice to help with ice fishing. So because they helped Anishinaabe people survive and we consider them a relative, I guess my question would be, wouldn't you help your relative survive?
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story on Ojibwe horses. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, Wisconsin has one of the strictest fetal protection laws in the nation. An investigative reporter tells us what it means. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Wisconsin passed a fetal protection law back in 1997 that's seen as one of the strictest in the nation. Wisconsin is one of just five states where pregnant people can be imprisoned on suspicion of drug use. About 400 pregnant people each year are investigated under the law. The law, known as Act 292, in effect grants many legal protections to zygotes. Phoebe Petrovic is an investigative reporter at Wisconsin Watch. I talked to her earlier today. Can you give us the basics of what this Act 292 actually does?
Yeah, so this aims to protect gestating fetuses from potential harm from drugs or alcohol. But in doing so, it deprives pregnant people of civil liberties and is considered by some the most extreme law in the country of this kind, because it allows anyone to file a complaint with the local child protective services saying that a pregnant person is using drugs or alcohol. And then that kicks off a process where ultimately the state can force a pregnant woman into treatment or civilly detain her against her will for the entire duration of her pregnancy. And if she refuses treatment, she can even end up in jail.
Talk just a bit about the origins. This is something comparable laws, though not as maybe severe, were happening in other states in the 90s. Give us a little bit of the background that led to states passing these kind of laws.
Yeah, so this really came about amid the war on drugs and this crack baby hysteria, when people thought that children born to mothers who use crack cocaine were doomed to lives of suffering, which has now been debunked. And there also was a very racist, overtly racist element to this, where we in the national media were focused on Black and brown mothers specifically, even though at the time, white folks were using crack cocaine actually more. So this law put unborn children under the auspices of the Department of Children and Families. It was a really small change with super big consequences. We're the only state to have a law like this that explicitly defines unborn children as human zygotes, embryos, and fetuses, basically from the moment of conception.
And you follow the story of a woman who's been at the center of this, including court cases, Tamara Lacher. Can you tell us a bit about her story?
Yeah. So when this all started in 2014 for her, she was 29 years old. She was a single woman. And her case really shows the extreme lengths or situations this law can put people in and the harm that it can cause. Because today she has a healthy 7 or 8 year old son who she loves, but she's still very traumatized by what happened to her. So back in 2014, she thought she might be pregnant. She went to the hospital for treatment for severe hypothyroidism and depression. One of the doctors said that it was amazing her fetus had even survived past the first trimester because she was so sick. Test results show that she was pregnant and had unconfirmed positives for some drugs. And so the hospital told the county, and they didn't let her leave the hospital. They had a court hearing while she was in the hospital where they said, you need to go to inpatient residential treatment. She was very clear that she didn't have a drug dependency. She was self-medicating for her hypothyroidism and depression, but she was here at the hospital supposed to be getting help. And she went back and forth, ended up having several court hearings, and was told throughout this that she was going to lose her child if she didn't cooperate. So she checked herself into jail instead of going through with treatment because she wanted to fight for her child. And with some lawyers, she was able to get a federal judge to say that this law was unconstitutionally vague and was voided. But that was later overturned on a technicality. And she really blames herself for that today.
Yeah, and that's an important point. It looked like this law was going to go away, ruled, as you said, unconstitutional. A very minor technicality of involving her leaving the state for a while means, if I have this right, this law, this Act 292, still in place here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's still in place today. And the interesting thing about it is that that legal justification that this is unconstitutionally vague still stands. Nothing, as far as I can tell, has been changed in the law to make it less vague. And so one of the ways to change this potentially is another brave woman like Tammy coming forward, who's experiencing this and challenging it again, because that justification kind of still stands. So it could be very persuasive to a judge in the future.
Talking to Phoebe Petrovic with Wisconsin Watch, looking at her reporting on Wisconsin's fetal protection law and the impact it can have. Phoebe, one side effect of this, and you write about this, is a concern that if a woman hears about this law and is worried that she's had past drug use, it might deter people from going and seeking prenatal medical care.
Right. That's a huge concern for many providers of mental health care, of substance use, and of obstetrics and gynecology. And I think one really good example of this is a woman named Alicia Beltran, who tried to challenge the law prior to Tammy Leitcher. She had a Percocet dependency. She weaned herself off of it successfully using Suboxone by herself because she couldn't afford medical treatment. And when the doctor found out and found that she had tested positive for Suboxone, they wanted her to go back on it. And she ended up being detained. And so when she had a second pregnancy, her provider told me, her OBGYN told me that she totally avoided getting prenatal care for that pregnancy because she had been so traumatized by being jailed after doing the right thing and recovering.
Now, we've had Roe v. Wade overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, bringing back Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban. Is there a concern that this is going to make this fetal protection law more active, more used in the state?
Yeah, so Tammy Leitcher's attorney, Freya Bowen, was really worried about that because, it sort of depends on if someone at the hospital decides to contact social services. But theoretically, anyone who shows up at a hospital who tests positive for pregnancy and drugs or alcohol could fall under the auspices of this. And the concern is that now that women who might have terminated their pregnancies might not have that option, might not have the ability to travel out of state, it could become more routinely enforced.
How often is this act enforced here in Wisconsin? How common is it that there are reported concerns and enforcement?
Yeah, so it's hard to know exactly, and it varies county to county, but we have about 400 women a year are investigated under this law. And so that means that the reports are made and they're screened in by Child Protective Services for future or for further investigation. And when these cases end up, if they end up winding their way through the court system, that happens in juvenile court, which means that those records are protected and sealed from the public. So it's really a black box. And we don't know how many women like Alicia Beltran, like Tammy Leitcher, end up in jail because they have tried to fight this law.
Alongside your piece, Phoebe, at Wisconsin Watch, you shared some advice from experts here for women who may be facing concerns about this situation during a pregnancy. What were some of the things, the resources people shared with you?
Yeah, so one provider in particular, his name is Dr. Charles Schauberger. He said that, people who are pregnant and using substances, they really should try to begin prenatal care as soon as possible because it's safer for them and their baby. They also shouldn't attempt to delay treatment or hide their pregnancy, but they should be really careful about who they get prenatal care from. Seeking out medical providers who are experienced in caring for women with substance use during pregnancy, drug treatment programs, and other women who have used drugs and had recent pregnancies might be good sources of referral if they don't know who to go to. And it's my understanding that Charles Schauberger and a couple other people are working on a database of providers who would be good, thoughtful, and not jump to calling CPS.
Phoebe, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you so much.
Phoebe Petrovic is an investigative reporter at Wisconsin Watch. She talked to us about her piece on Wisconsin's fetal protection law. You can find a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a new congressional session starts off with drama in the U.S. House. We'll get the latest news wherever it is tomorrow and look at the big issues in the year to come. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.